Welcome to Major Bad Blast and the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This October 4th, 2016 edition, episode 98 of Major Bad Blast comes to you live from the Mud Hut in New Mexico and in Belize. Our thanks to Afrozen for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Today's a call-in show, so please give us a toll-free shout-out at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. And since Guy is in the jungle, his connection may be a little subpar, so we may have a bit of delay, so please bear with us if that is the case. We'll cover our travels over the last 3 months, as we've been on a little bit of a break, a hiatus, as well as some other interesting tidbits on our way to oblivion. We'll start off with Guy. Guy, why don't you tell us a little bit about Belize?
As you point out, rumors of our extinction were greatly exaggerated. 3 months is not quite forever. I have moved from a rock pile in the desert to a rock outcrop in the jungle, from a place sure to run out of habitat for human and animal soon, to a place that'll happen even sooner. During global warming extinctions, the poles harbor life longer than the equator. So I'm often asked why I moved. According to gossip, rumor, and innuendo on the internet, I moved here with my girlfriend after killing my wife. I'm going to put it a little bit differently today for the show. My wife and best friend of more than three decades and I were divorced in late of this year. As with many relationships, ours ultimately became difficult to sustain in the way which we had become accustomed. The ways we grew apart overwhelmed the ways we grew together. This is not to suggest I don't love Sheila. The only love of my life controlled more than half of my life and hers. I love her deeply. I suspect it's an eternal condition. And paradoxically, I move for love and for hate, as the latter emotion came to dominate my thoughts about the land of the me and the home of the crave. That's America, country of my birth. I was told countless times to love it or leave it, based on my last two decades as a sort of like, and I chose the third way, trying to improve it. I finally come to realize American empire cannot be improved. It can only go away. It, too, is a condition. As with my tenure at the University of Arizona, I left America in fear and disgust. I landed in Belize, where I wanted to live for more than a decade. The most pragmatic reason is that Belize is the only Central or South American country in which English is the official language. But I also moved here for love, as I mentioned. Love of all life, love of living, commonality here. Love of living instead of making a living. Love of anarchy, consistent with the agrarian anarchy practiced here throughout most of the country. In my case, there's also the pursuit of polyamory, as I came to view monogamy as another expression of ownership, reflective of patriarchy or civilization. I am in no way suggesting others follow my path, unlike the first time I made a break and left the University of Arizona, when I thought that it would be a good idea for people to follow my path. It's been quite the emotionally shattering past decade for me, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody. So that's my long-winded response to why I moved and moved to Belize. I live on a property with five other adults and a couple of youngsters. We are creating Homestead 2.0, not because it will extend our lives when civilization meets its overdue demise, instead because it allows us to work together on projects for the common good. If you can track, that's Aristotle's definition of friendship. And one minor example, yesterday we pushed, pulled, and cajoled a 1,000-gallon cistern, a really heavy tank for capturing and storing rainwater, up cliffs of insanity. It took five of the adults on this property all afternoon to do that. Big fun.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've had experience with cisterns on the property here when we worked with you in 2011, and you need water, so cisterns are a must. And I remember we built a cistern here where we put it up on a platform in the hopes that it would be gravity-fed. But like a lot of things that people try and we try, we learn from our failures. It didn't exactly work out, but you don't know those things until you do them and you see the results. And so my trips and my travels...
That's exactly right. What?
Go ahead.
Go ahead. I was just about to ask you to tell us about your trip to Alaska with Karen and your parents.
Yeah, so I went on a little bucket list trip that my parents wanted to do, which was to drive from Phoenix, Arizona to Alaska and back. And we did it in my dad's SUV, my parents' SUV, in a small teardrop trailer, which my parents slept in. And then Karen and I slept in a tent, which was attached to the trailer itself. And we left here really right after our last show in July, and we headed up towards Glacier National Park and Yellowstone and made our way through some of Alberta and most of BC up into the Yukon, up into Alaska, and then back down the West Coast and back into Arizona. So it ended up being about 11,000 miles on the road. And it was an interesting trip because... it's a trip I would never do again, but I'm glad I did it because I really got to see some things that probably aren't going to be around much longer. And, you know, I'm talking obviously about glaciers. And one of the things we did stop and take a gander at was the Columbia ice fields, which are between the national parks of Banff and Jasper and actually on the kind of the border between Alberta and B.C. And after we stopped there, it's kind of a rest stop area, and there were bus tours going to the ice fields, which you could see off into the distance. We didn't take the bus tour. We just kind of sat there, took some pictures, and looked through the binocs, and just kind of took it all in. And then we went camping that night in Jasper, and we were camped next to a gentleman who had lived in that general area his whole life. I'd say he was probably in his mid-60s maybe, and he had told us that when he was at the Columbia Ice Fields in 1961, that they were about 100 meters from the highway, and now you have to take a bus tour to get to them, which by just kind of looking at it from where I was standing, looked like it was about 2 miles away. So in about 55 years or so, they had receded, according to him, about 2 miles, which was quite shocking. Also through the travels, you know, we started seeing the results of spruce beetles, which I'm assuming, and maybe you could clarify this, Guy, is I'm assuming it's connected to climate change in the warming of, you know, the Yukon and British Columbia. And so it seemed like the spruce beetle population was going up. And then I think the biggest thing that I noticed on the trip was, because we went to six national parks, was something within myself, and I think what, I don't know who coined the phrase, but I've heard it, it's called, and I've written a little bit about it, it's called nature deficit disorder. And I started to notice it in myself once I started observing other people, because I observed their behavior, and then I started to observe or reflect back on my own behavior during the trip. And it's one of those trips where you take a camera with you, but sometimes you regret that you bring the camera because you become a slave to that camera. You think you have to take a picture of everything, and then you're starting to view the entire experience through a, you know, a small frame of a camera. And when we went to Denali, we were on a bus trip, which was about 8 hours long. There's only one road in Denali. It's an out and back, and we did a 120-mile round trip out and back. And we had a lot of German tourists on our bus, and they were simply out of hand. They were literally crawling over everyone and anyone, including us, and bumping people with their cameras swinging to get a picture of anything that moved. And this went on for 8 hours. And, you know, I was like, these people are ridiculous. But then I started to reflect back on myself. I wasn't as aggressive as they were in my own picture taking. But at the same time, it was one of those things that, you know, while we were driving, you know, to these places, anything that sort of stuck out, you know, you pulled over, you stared at it, and you looked at it, and you took pictures of it and video of it. And it really started to dawn on me that I don't see these things in my everyday life. And why is that? Well, and it's clear because of this show, we talk about it, and you know, we both write about it, and we live in the cult of civilization. And when you live in the cult of civilization, you do not experience nature. You experience the zoo, or you experience a preserve, or you experience a park. But to experience live animals walking past you, like mountain goats and mountain sheep, and seeing grizzlies, I mean, you literally freak out because it's something that just doesn't come into your life. And for good reason, because we pretty much paved everything, and, you know, progress is taking its toll. So that was my trip. I mean, it was 49 days. It was just under 11,000 miles. I'm so fortunate to have seen the things, you know, and experienced the things I did on the trip. But at the end of it, there's a sadness about it, because I felt like I was looking at the last pieces of pristine wilderness that were just being overrun by tourists, including myself, up and down tour buses with their cameras, and, you know, not really absorbing it, but more like gawking at it. And so that was my basic experience. And, you know, I'm still reflecting on it. It's been over for a month, so.
Well, yeah, it's nice that you're able to reflect. It's nice that you're able to sort of take yourself out of the moment of your own activity and notice things like nature deficit disorder, which was described, I think, more than 5 years ago, and point out that you are actually seeing the last of these great places. Dar Jamail's list post, his latest climate change dispatch at Truth Out, came out yesterday morning, I believe. And in it, he interviewed park rangers, including Alaska. And according to him, they said that they can see the glaciers receding every day. They go up and visit every day, and they can see the changes coming every single day. That's how rapidly these things are transpiring. I'd like to point out, for many years, I was accused of contributing greatly to climate change, apparently abrupt climate change. But you went 11,000 miles. I think it's all your fault, buddy. That's all I have to say about that.
Yeah, I got a lot about that. Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, you know, and it, on some aspects, you know, you still feel some of that guilt about, yeah, I'm traveling, you know, I'm burning all this fuel and stuff. But I mean, at this point, you know, it's like, come on, what are you going to really do? It's like Derek Jensen always says, you know, I can give up flying, but that's not going to stop the airlines. It's not going to stop people from booking flights. And I get it. People make choices. People become vegans, you know, and people live off grid and do what they do. And so I just look at, you know, it's just another choice I made. I thought it was important for me to see Glacier National Park while it still had glaciers.
You know, it's not your fault, and it's not my fault, and it's almost nobody's individual personal fault. This whole thing started several thousand years ago with civilization. We didn't get to vote on that. We were born into it. So it's not our fault, and as you and I have discovered, by merely making our own personal choices, by attempting to walk away from the set of living arrangements into which we were born, it doesn't change a thing. Nobody else is walking away. Nobody else is following us after us just because privileged white men and teachers. So I don't think we need to feel any particular guilt about a situation we were born into, and that we're actually, I would argue, doing more than most people in terms of not only walking away, but serving as witnesses to the ongoing disruption, identifying much more than most people that there, in fact, are downsides associated with the living arrangements.
Yeah, absolutely. And I like that term, bearing witness. All right, we have a caller. We have Morris from Brooklyn. Morris, you there?
Hear me? Can you hear
me?
Hello, can you hear me?
We can hear you. Can you hear us?
I can hear you.
Okay, you have a question or a comment?
Yeah, I'd like to make a statement and then point out something about civilization being a heat engine that I never heard you mention. I don't believe we should have an attitude of inevitable near-term extinction. I agree with David Wasdell and similar climatologists. These are climatologists who have impeccable credentials, I'm sure you'll agree, especially David Wasdell. And he says that, he's aware of all the near-term catastrophic scenarios that you're aware of and, in fact, agrees with you. That humanity's situation seems hopeless, but also he insists and others insist that despite the apparent predicament, that there's a reasonable small chance that humanity could come up with a solution, and it's our obligation to try to figure out what may, even though it's a small chance, may stave off the catastrophe. I'd also like to point out something about civilization being a heat engine. Tim Garrett does not refer to it as a mechanistic situation. Rather, everything I've seen and read of his analysis is that it's historical, and only because of psychological and behavioral reasons, if a more advanced segment of humanity gives up heat engine inducers, the less advanced segment of humanity will use those inducers simply because it will make life much easier, much more quickly. So it's just a matter of education, or of educating all of humanity of the predicament we're in. And Noam Chomsky has repeatedly pointed out that there have been several completely unexpected revolutions in thought and behavior, such as attitudes towards slavery. And so it's the same thing with our climate situation. It's a matter of explaining to those who would take up fossil fuels that they cannot do so because they'll only ruin their own lives and all of humanity's situation. I'd like your answers to those two points.
Okay, well, we'll talk to them. Guy, you want to start?
Yeah, I have a couple of comments regarding Tim Garrett's work and civilization as a heat engine. We know that civilization, however it's maintained, based on Tim Garrett's work, and it's pretty voluminous at this point. So we know that civilization itself is a heat engine, and we all know that it keeps heating the planet as long as it's sustained, based on historic evidence, as put out by the caller. We also know that when civilization is turned off, especially if it is turned off abruptly, the planet will experience warming of an additional 3 degrees C, more or less, in a very, very short period of time. You think we're in a climate change now. Turning off the heat engine at the end of the show today means that we heat up an additional 3 degrees Celsius of the 1.6 or so of the baseline we're at right now. And that's going to happen in a matter of days, not weeks, not months, not years, but days. So we're going to experience superheating at a rate way too rapid for us and other complex organisms to keep up. A little bit about bottoms. I've been in considerable email contact with Peter Wadhams, who was until recently the director of the Ocean Physics Program at Cambridge University. He was forced into retirement from that position despite having taken a more than 40 expeditions on and under the ice in the Arctic, specifically because he was saying things that were steeped in evidence. In one of those email exchanges I had with Peter Wadhams, he questioned some of the data I was putting together. This from an essay called The Politics and Science of Our Demise from August 1st on the blog. And the reason he questioned the evidence I was putting together is because I added the feedbacks and added the temperature increases from feedbacks and also from the absence of global dimming when civilization goes away. And he pointed out that it probably won't be additive. It'll be multiplicative. The situation is far worse than I have painted it. His response, as with many people who have children or grandchildren, is that we need to geoengineer our way out of the situation, a prospect that has been broadly pointed out as useless or worse by the referee journal literature and also by the United States National Academy of Science and its European equivalent within the last year or so.
Yeah, you know, it seems that, you know, and Morris brought up this point that if there's any chance of doing something, we should do it. But it's one of those things that we're stuck because everything we do is based off the story of civilization. So there is no solution coming from the actual problem. And the problem is civilization. It's actually not the problem. It's the predicament. And the predicament is creating the so-called solutions. And if we keep looking to those or that particular foundation for a way out, it's a self-reinforcing feedback loop.
I said, since you mentioned the 3°C warm-up, that's why I referred to David Wasdale's insistence that we try to figure out a solution, even though it's not imaginable right now, even though it seems to be an absolute predicament. He insists that we try to come up with a solution, some way out solution that may stave off the catastrophe.
Yeah, but who are the we? The we are those of us living in civilization. So I don't know how that's going to happen if we only have a picture in our head of what is possible. And what is possible, every single time we've come up with it, is based off keeping civilization running. And so we're not going to indigenous people. We're not going to uncontacted tribes in the Amazon or Papua New Guinea. We're going to guys who make a living off civilization. And, of course, they're going to come up with ideas that are based on civilization and keeping this going. So I just see this, we're trying to, you know, whatever the phrase is, squeeze juice out of a turnip.
Right, and it's not as if Mike or I, either one, are fans of near-term human extinction. You know, it's not that we're... I'm frequently accused of being the lead proponent of near-term human extinction, as if I think it's a great idea that I'm proposing this idea, and I think it's awesome the humans are gone by next week. That's not the case at all. Neither of us is a proponent of this idea. Ugh. Anyway, we have a caller, Annie from Syracuse. Annie, are you with us?
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi, you guys. I'm so glad you're back on the radio. I think I speak for many people when I say I've missed you since July. A lifetime has passed.
I'm blushing.
Well, I just want to thank both of you. And I first ran across Guy McPherson's blog some 3 years ago, maybe even longer. And as harsh and dismal and ruinous as it may be, I want to hear the truth. And you're the only source of that truth in any depth, in any detail. And thanks to you, I think... I've gone through certainly anger. I think I've left anger in the past. Mostly I'm sad about things right now. And but I also am experiencing a freedom. I knew as an individual, as as a clued-in individual, I knew that something was deeply, deeply wrong. I mostly attached that to politics and corporate shenanigans, but I realize now it's much, much deeper, much more longer-lived, and I mostly had nothing to do with it and cannot do anything about it. And as a result of your information, which is so compelling, and nobody has come forward to say he's wrong about this, his reading of the science is wrong, they're crazy, they're whacked out, with any degree of credibility, I accept it as the truth. And I just want to thank you for giving me the time in my own life, my own individual infinitesimal life, to adapt my brain, my mind, my belief to the end of civilization, the end of human life, the end of this idyllic sort of paradise in this very narrow range of capability of sustaining life. And I'm so glad I have a chance to adjust to what's coming and try to use this time to bolster my equanimity and bolster my peaceful outlook and my acceptance. So I just called in to say thank you so much. You have really done a great service in my life, and I'm sure I speak for other listeners as well. Thanks a lot.
All right.
Thank you, Annie. We very much appreciate your words. Your expression of kindness is something we get a lot of. So thank you very much for saying that. I look forward to meeting you live and in person. This is the Annie from Syracuse, I think it is, within a couple of months in upstate New York. Mike, do you have a follow-on?
Thanks.
Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to get the good comments once in a while. I know you take a lot of grief, and I take very little of it. I think I get some of your overflow, so to speak. But it is nice because, you know, when you write and talk about these things and speak about them, sometimes you wonder what the hell we're doing. And when you get a call like that or an email that we get once in a while, it's just it's a good moment. All right, we have Suzanne from Alaska. Suzanne, you there?
Yeah. Hey, Mike.
Hey,
guy.
How are you?
Pretty good, except I'm a little pissed right now. You were in Alaska and you didn't come out here? I swear to God. Valdez was gorgeous, and you could have gone to see the Columbia Glacier.
I was in Alaska with my parents.
Okay, well, I guess
that's
you
a
got
different
to see thing. It. I'm happy for you.
Yeah, thank you. Next time, when I'm on my own.
Yeah. And, Guy, the fish is getting sent out today, so.
Awesome. Thanks. That's animalistic. Thank you very much.
And I'm glad to hear you guys back on the radio. It's been too long, but I know things have been happening and good for all of us. Just living in the now and having the appreciation of our lives is vital. It's the life's blood. I'm so happy we have it. And people who open their minds have it. And those who don't, well, we have to be kind to them because it's kind of like a disability now. It's purposeful ignorance. And I have a question. I'm rambling, but I actually have a question. Yeah. I'm up here. We're having a wonderful fall. It's 5 to 10 degrees above normal everywhere. Just gorgeous fall. And, of course, that's lovely. But I have a question about the methane. I keep running it back through my mind. Okay, it breaks down, water vapor, et cetera, et cetera. But what am I going to see as it gets more potent up here? I mean, I know it swirls out around the world and everything, and it dilutes. But are there, like, pockets of methane that happen? I mean, that's where I'm kind of in the dark about that. And like I said, I'm really glad you guys are back, and congratulations, Guy, on your new life. Enjoy, enjoy. And I'll let you talk now.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Suzanne. It's the hard part is knowing what the situation is going to look like in the near future. There's a new expedition in the Laptev Sea, and Siberian Times just reported on some of their findings this morning. And it's an expedition led by Igor Samatov, Natalia Shakova's longtime partner, who has been making direct observations in the region for a long time. And basically the take-home message is in the headline, Arctic methane gas emission significantly increased since 2014. So things are happening, as we are fond of saying here on this show, faster than expected. And so the situation is proceeding much more rapidly than anticipated. And initially, of course, the methane impacts on warming will be local and then regional. But within a year or so, all of that methane will be evenly distributed throughout Earth's atmosphere. And that's why the whole planet will experience very rapid warming at that point, with methane being 100 times or more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide at the short temporal scales, meaning relatively immediately. Samatov does what almost all researchers do because they're conservative. He points out that methane is 30 times more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, but that is badly underestimating the near-term impact of methane as compared to carbon dioxide. And I would argue that near-term is all we have at this point. So continuing to downplay the situation regarding methane is doing no great service to humanity, which is something scientists used to take quite seriously.
Okay. Well, hopefully that answers your question, Suzanne. We have Matt from Florida. Matt, you there?
I am here. Can you hear me, Mike?
We can hear you.
Mike and Guy, good to hear you back on the radio. So happy that you decided to finally broadcast the good news.
Woo! Thanks, man. Appreciate it.
Woo! Well, the big issue that bothered me was the initial apologies. The two of you sitting there wringing your hands about flying up to Alaska, et cetera, et cetera. You know, this was a canard that they threw at our esteemed political climate scientist Al Gore, that, you know, he was some sort of hypocrite for not having enough solar panels. This is a public relations ploy to reduce the attention on the message, and the message clearly is correct. The science is correct. The solution to the message is what the first caller was desperately trying to find. And the idea of having an action-based approach to this predicament, I think, fits in and dovetails quite nicely with Guy's life of excellence model, is that for those of us who really have enough motivation and time, effort, and energy to do what they can do, the pursuit of a solution is that excellence. And if the entire planet, if all of humanity can be brought together on the pursuit of creating excellent solutions to this, you're right. The woman was right that there's a chance. We are looking at the math right now and saying it's not much of a chance, but the pursuit of excellence is certainly worth its effort. And I hear the frustration of our math. We just have this really big problem with math. And the difficulty of dealing with the math is that we're in a very, very, very serious predicament. So I guess my question is your math assailable? Is there a way, if you were going to attack yourself, Mike, if I hired you to say, you've got to prove Guy wrong, Guy, I'm going to hire you to prove you wrong, is there an angle that I could use to make your math sound bad enough that I could convince 4 billion people to make radical changes to save the planet? Where is the missing piece of mathematical mistakes that we could use to convince others that there's enough time to do something? That we could say, hey, look, there is enough variability in this particular mathematical problem. Yeah, we could do something. Please critique yourself.
Okay, Guy, go ahead. Matt will take we'll take it off the air. Go ahead.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks for that question. And I'm open to that sort of criticism. I try to get the information that I have concluded out there to as many people as possible. And thus, the importance of that email exchange with Wadhams, in which he concluded that I was underselling the story. It's worse than I've actually indicated, that the feedbacks are probably multiplicative, not additive. So, again, I don't think, you know, that over the course of a few years, we are on the verge of doing anything that will be useful. It's doing things. It's doing everything that got into this mess in the first place. And I don't think that more doing is the right approach. That's why I think it was September 1st I posted an essay on the blog called Time to Live? And pointing out that it's time for me, at least, to be a human being rather than a human doing, because I think all that doing has contributed in an exponential way to our demise. So I think it's time we stopped, keep stacking the solutions, because we know that each of those solutions so far has created myriad problems and ultimately leading to this predicament. So let's just first do no harm. Let's just stop. I think the evidence is unassailable, but of course I'm pretty close to it, so maybe I'm mistaken about that. And I certainly criticized for it from people who look a lot like me every time I present it or every time I write about it. Mike,
yeah, I mean,
maybe an introduction?
It seems like it's about control, and what you're talking about is, why don't we first give up control first and see what happens? You know, we keep trying to control every single situation, and there is no controlling this. That's what civilization is. It's a control mechanism, and clearly it's not working. And so I think if we just first simply let go and see what happens in our lives, you know, that's kind of the way I look at it.
I absolutely, my solutions, and I actually have three solutions. My solutions are these. One, remain calm. Nothing is under control. And I think that's that letting go, as you mentioned, Mike. Two, pursue excellence. And as Matt pointed out, that's what I've been promulgating, not from human extinction, but the pursuit of excellence. And this is from Socrates from 2,600 years ago. And third, to pursue love, to do what you love, to love what you do, to get off the treadmill if you view your current life as a treadmill. I don't think any of those is bad advice, even if our species will persist a few thousand more years, and difficult for me to imagine that our species would. But even if we do, I don't see anything wrong with any of those.
Right, absolutely. All right, we have another caller. We have Pete from Rochester. Pete, you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you great. You have a question or a comment,
right,
Pete?
Great. I'm glad you guys are back. I've missed your program. And I was about to call you just a couple of weeks before you left. I had noticed an article that was published at Counterpunch titled Fukushima, Worse Than a Disaster. Any chance you heard or saw that article?
I did not. Guy,
yes.
Did you?
I saw that.
Okay, in the article, I think it was Hunziker. Stated that they finally, TEPCO, the person in charge of decommissioning the Fukushima reactors, finally admitted they have no idea where 600 tons of molten corium is and could possibly be burrowing into the earth. And my only question was, well, where else would it be except if some of it migrated into the ocean? And I was wondering if in your calculations that the heat that's being emitted from the molten corium is in your calculation.
Yeah, fine question, and no, it's not. I have no information that would allow me to calculate the amount of heating. I don't. I think the situation is truly dire, even if we don't count ionizing radiation don't count nuclear facilities, China syndrome. I don't want to get into the situation of talking about things that I don't really have a lot of knowledge or history dealing with, because I'm subject to enough criticism the way it is, thanks. So I tend to stop with abrupt climate change and occasionally mention of this mass extinction on Earth, that sort of thing. Okay,
well, Edward. Gentlemen, thank you for your work.
Thank you.
Oh, sorry. Sorry. Thank you. I appreciate the call.
Okay, we have Edward
from Pennsylvania. Okay. You still with us?
Hello.
Hello, Edward. Is that you?
Yes, it is.
Edward, hit us with it.
All right. You have a question, comment?
Well, I do have a comment, and nice to hear you again, Guy. I've given a tremendous amount of thought to this, obviously, because I have not a whole hell of a lot else to do. But several of the reasons that are what's so frustrating to me is that I still believe that it would be possible with a truly concerted human effort to mitigate this to some degree, to potentially keep the planet from getting catastrophically warm. But when you factor in the truth of the matter that that humans are not going to change their behavior when it comes to vehicles, electricity, and all of and the things that alter the atmosphere chemically and the oceans, and when you have this whole business with the corporations who seem to be stuck in a monkey trap and they just can't let go, and they're going to drag the rest of us with them. And when you consider the nuclear issue, which is I don't see a way around it. I suspect that some idiot is going to decide to use the nuclear option. If someone's going to go, oh, God, we're going to be all dead, so we might as well just go ahead and stop it now. But the frustrating thing is that the approach that I would take, were I some mythical God, of course, I'm an atheist, so I don't believe in God anymore, the approach that I would take would be to attack the methane first. Malcolm Light has posted time and time and time again on using electromagnetic radiation, i.e. Radio waves, to disassociate the hydrogen from those carbon atoms and produce nanodiamonds. And of course, the hydrogen would oxidize immediately into water vapor and other hydroxyls. But the idea of us ever being able to radically stop putting CO2 into the air, it's just not ever going to happen. So I think Guy is 100% right to be convinced that the only real changes that we can do are within ourselves, and to enjoy each and every moment. And that's the path that I have chosen to take. But it's frustrating for me because I have children and I have grandchildren, and even none of them can even grasp when I try to explain to them that things are not going to be the way they've always been. You know, things are going to get real bad. It just like either goes over their heads or they shut their ears. Some of them must think I'm crazy. I don't know. It's enough to make a person cry, which I do quite often because it's the only way I can relieve the stress and tension that I have. But I would like to thank the both of you for having the courage and the honesty and the dignity to speak the truth as you know it. In my mind, hopefully you would be wrong somehow, but I can't see any way that you're not. So, but anyhow, Guy, it's good to talk to you again. If you're ever up, I don't know if you get to New York. I I can't get around to much these days because my my own personal health situation has changed somewhat. But I'm working on that. But I feel almost idiotic in some ways to even think about it. But I still dream that we would at least try. You know, I would rather go down fighting and trying to do something than to just say, oh, the hell with it, you know. But individually, I don't see how we can change it at this point in time. So anyhow, you guys have a wonderful day. It's good to see you back. I saw your problem with your little cistern there. You're going to have troubles with that, trust me. But I'm glad to hear that you're happy and living your life and being able to express the love that most of us have inherent within ourselves. So thanks again. And with that, I'll just go ahead and shut up. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Thank you, Edward. Thank you for the call. We'll take you online now. The point of catastrophic warming has already come for the millions who die every year as a result of climate change. And I strongly suspect that if the pulling the levers of industry, including government elected officials and the people in major corporations who have significant power, I suspect if they had a solution, they would be implementing it. They have some grandchildren, too. I don't think they, like we, actually want our species to go extinct anytime at all, much less in the near future. And I think, you know, money becomes a non-issue when you have something like the Federal Reserve System or the European Central Bank able to print money and just churn it out. And by print, I mean produce electronic digits on a screen. So I think if there's a solution, we would be implementing it right now. And I just don't see that beyond the individual personal solutions that we've already talked about. I just don't think there's anything rooted in society.
No, I would agree with you, Guy. And I think Edward's heartfelt call and very much appreciated call, I think he said it best with the monkey trap. And I think for personally, I think if you can just let go of that fruit and pull your hand out of the trap, you'll find some personal liberation moving towards the exit of this culture. And that's really, at this point, I think all you can do. And I think that's what we're both trying to do, you know, as best we can. And we're not doing it well all the time, but that's it's the only way I can see that is sane, because, you know, trying to talk to children, grandchildren, aunts, uncles, friends, relatives, it's like talking to madness, because they live in madness. And if you see the madness, you aren't going to convince anybody of it, because they all think it's life. All right, we got Dries from Philly, one of our favorite callers. Dries, you there?
Yes, hello.
Hey.
Hey, Dries.
Hey, how you guys doing?
How are you doing? Good to hear from you again.
I'm all right. I'm actually enjoying the great outdoors in the southern part of the United States. The sun is shining on my face. I'm enjoying these moments. And particularly listening to you gentlemen again on the show. Welcome back. Thanks for coming back to us. I agree with all the other callers that called in and that expressed extreme gratitude to hearing you gentlemen again.
Appreciate it. Good to hear you again.
Yeah, thanks. And I had a couple. I've been waiting patiently. I only had two things today. But first off, I know I've been hearing Guy, you as well as Mike, talk about some of the, you know, the negative feedback, pun intended, I guess, from people actually, you know, kind of beating up on you guys for the message and some of the information that you've been putting out, you know, all the disagreement and all that stuff like that. I'm going to get personal, and this is my weighing on it. I always tell you guys that I can't thank you enough for, you know, putting forth the effort to let us know what's really going on out here, because I look at it as personally, I look at it as a sign of disrespect from the people who are in authority or in power for lying to us and bullshitting us all this time. And this is why I respect you two gentlemen even more, because the fact that you would put it all online and put yourself out there to give us this information shows the degree of respect that you have for your fellow humans. And the people who refuse to do so just show me how disrespectful or lack thereof that they have for us. They don't have, they don't respect us. They don't care about us. Like George Carlin said, they don't give a fuck about us. You know? I mean, I hate to be that blunt, but this is how we feel, you know? And again, I respect you gentlemen even more just for the hard work that you're doing. And I that's why I always, you know, try to show respect in return by never missing a show and always, you know, keeping my ear to the street, so to speak, whenever you guys put any, you know, any publications out, any articles, or any weigh-ins on what's happening around us. Which is funny because I also wanted to tell you gentlemen congratulations. Congratulations, because as you predicted, we've crossed that threshold. We're well over 400 parts per million. So, hey, what can I say? You're right. I also saw something online. I don't know how true it is, but speaking of how much. Hello, can you guys hear me? I'm sorry.
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't want to keep rambling on and sort of, you know, get disconnected or anything. But I heard something about speaking of the polls melting. A place that people call the third pole, that they've nicknamed the third pole, which is I believe the Himalayas, seem to be melting at a very fast rate. Even some say even faster than the Arctic and Antarctic. I was just wondering if you had come across any information about that situation. They were interviewing people who lived in that region, you know, where, you know, India and China, and how it affected their major, you know, rivers over there, like the Yangtze in China and the Ganges over in India. I was just curious if you gentlemen heard anything about that, and if so, what's your weigh in, or is it even true or not?
Okay, thanks for the call, Dries. Go ahead, Gadi. Yeah.
Thanks, Dries. We appreciate it. The third pole, as it's called, refers to the Himalayas, and that's a huge source of ice and therefore water, consistent with a parallel to the north and south poles, where we think of as big ice. But the Himalayas are, the in particular, the snow-covered mountains surrounding the Tibetan Plateau holds the largest store of permanent ice and permafrost outside the poles themselves. So that's why it's sometimes called the third pole. And they're a major source of water. They form headwaters for 10 of Asia's biggest rivers, and those bring drinking water, power, and irrigation directly to 210 million people. So the bay, river basins themselves indirectly support more than 1.3 billion. So we're talking about a lot of ice, therefore a lot of water. And it's like all the other ice on the planet, it's going away, much to the detriment of humanity. And it's happening, as we always say, faster than expected.
Faster than expected. Thanks for the call, Dries. Before we go, my book guy may actually be out in the next few weeks after about 8 months of processing.
Applause all around the world.
Yeah. Holy crap. It's so funny because I sent it to you, you know, to look at it and do some editing in June of 2015, and here we are in October of 2016, and it may be out actually in a couple weeks. So take a look. I'll post some links when it does actually arrive, and you can probably start doing some pre-ordering soon. It should be up soon on Amazon and Barnes & Noble. The title is Chasing a Different Carrot, A Manifesto for the Predicament of Privilege. And so you may be able to search for that within at least the next few weeks, I would think, because I got it's the final stage, and you should be hearing when it's printed any day now. So we'll see. Any day now sometimes turns into a month, though. So. All right.
Guy, any last thoughts? Yeah, you know, just a closing comment. I'm posting far less frequently on the blog because it's nearly impossible from here. A guy named Lord Ashcroft from Britain owns all the communication system. And if he lived here, it would be a hell of a lot better. But he lives in Britain, so he doesn't really care that I can't get on the Internet on a regular basis. So
right.
Whatever. That's why my demise, or near demise, has come about. I look forward to broadcasting with you from the Mott in a month from now. And
yeah.
Why don't you take us away?
Okay, yeah, if all goes well, we'll be here in a month. So that about wraps it up this week. Make sure to like us on our Facebook page, NatureBath Last and Progressive Radio Network, or join our Facebook group as well. It's NatureBath Last on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show. And please share the link widely when posted from the archives. Also, continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. And you can follow my work, my weekly essay every Sunday at the Good Men Project. We'll see you on the radio, hopefully, the first Tuesday of November 1st, if all goes according to plan, which it rarely does. If you miss us live, make sure to find us on the archives at PRN.FM, Stitcher, or rate us on iTunes. Thanks again to our listeners and Afterzen for his music. Until next time, and thanks for the calls. Remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end, Ninja Brass Land.
That's almost 52 years so far, the world has become a worse and worse place. Every year we have polluted more water than the year before. Every year there's been less clean air than there was the year before that. Every year there are fewer species on the planet than the year before that. We're driving 200 species.